Welcome, everyone, to the next in the Research Group on Constitutional Studies lecture series. The Research Group on Constitutional Studies brings together researchers and students working on constitutional government, political theory, public law, and political philosophy, studying basic questions into the values, principles, and institutions of a free society and constitutional government. The lecture series, supported by a generous gift to McGill from the Aurea Foundation, aims to bring leading scholars and researchers working on such questions, particularly those who work at the overlaps and intersections of the social sciences, law, and political theory and philosophy, to McGill in a way that will draw student life and particularly undergraduate life more closely into the realities of what research on hard questions about constitutional government and the values, institutions, and principles of free society looks like, constantly aiming to say that we know less than we think we do, and that the easy claims of how things fit together should be called into question. This is the second to last in this year's RGCS lecture series. The final event in the series will be a debate on April 3rd between Chandran Kukuthas from the London School of Economics and Kit Wellman from Washington University, St. Louis, on open borders and the right to immigrate. It is a pleasure today to welcome back to McGill, though I'm meeting him for the first time after some 10 years of online acquaintance and conversation, to welcome back to McGill Professor Scott Lemieux, Professor of Political Science at the College of St. Rose. Professor Lemieux holds a BA and MA in Political Science from McGill University, where he studied with our own Dean Manfredi, and has gone on to be a leading emerging scholar of judicial politics and of the place that the judiciary holds in the analysis of American politics and of constitutional government. It is, I think, especially appropriate that he follows in the lecture series Ilya Soman, a law professor who gave us an account of democratic politics. We now have a political scientist come to give us an account of the place of the law and the judiciary in an analysis of democratic systems. After leaving McGill, Professor Lemieux took his PhD from the University of Washington and has gone on to publish articles in such venues as Polity, Studies in Law, Politics, and Society, the Journal of Supreme Court History, and the American Journal of Comparative Law. He is also a well-known public commentator on American politics and, in particular, on the judiciary in American politics, both at the group blog of political scientists he helped found, Lawyers, Guns, and Money, and as a columnist at the American Prospect. Please join me in welcoming Scott Lemieux.
Well, thank you, everybody. Thanks so much to Professor Levy for bringing me back to McGill. I see some familiar faces who, I want to be clear, should not be blamed for anything that I'm about to say here today, but it's fantastic to be here. And the origins of this project, you know, I think are natural if you spent any time at all thinking about the role of Supreme Court in American politics, that as scholars have tried to make sense of the last few decades of the Supreme Court, and I would say particularly the sort of Berger and early Rehnquist courts, where there was an activism that sort of was well over the map ideologically, that the court was to some degree trending towards the right, but there were a lot of sort of major decisions that liberals liked as well as some decisions that conservatives liked. So there was a sort of ideologically heterodox court that whose sort of common thread seemed to be increasingly aggressive assertions of judicial supremacy. You know, one example would be when the Supreme Court finally wrote an opinion affirming the famous Miranda decision from the mid-60s. It was actually written by Chief Justice Rehnquist, who had spent most of his tenure on the court arguing that the case had been wrongly decided. And many people interpreted that as saying that, you know, regardless of whether or not he approved of past judicial opinions, he was going to be sure that the court and not Congress, which had tried to replace the Miranda standard, would make that decision. And so my favorite example of this is that John Gibson and a team of political scientists have a survey, and they sort of give this to try to determine, you know, public reaction towards the court. How much does the public know about the court? How do they perceive it? And one of the questions in the survey is, do you happen to know who has the last say when there is a conflict over the meaning of the Constitution? The United States Supreme Court, the United States Congress, or the President? The way the survey is coded is that if the person being surveyed doesn't answer the Supreme Court, they got the question wrong. So it's sort of taken as a fact that, you know, if there's a conflict over the Constitution, the Supreme Court has the final say. Whenever one thinks of this normatively, it's just sort of a brute empirical fact that judicial supremacy characterizes the relationship between the courts and the political branches in the United States. And, of course, there are plenty of other, you know, scholars who make similar claims, which, if you're interested, you can see my paper. But, you know, it's obviously a fairly common assumption, both in the scholarship as well as in more sort of popular analysis of the court. Now, what got me thinking about this even more was that I'm part of a group of scholars who have urged other scholars in the field to consider the fact that the roots of judicial power lay in the interests of the political branches, that generally the courts have gained power in part because other political elites want the courts to have power. So perhaps the seminal article in this field was Mark Graber's classic article, The Non-Majoritarian Difficulty, where he looked at cases from slavery to antitrust to abortion, and found that what has generally been perceived as the courts trying to impose a solution on the other political branches was much more complicated. That, in fact, in all of these cases, the political branches had in various ways, either directly or indirectly, invited the courts to resolve the underlying political dispute. And many scholars following the wake of this have found other cases. So, for example, George Lovell, in his book Legislative Deferrals, tried to address this longstanding controversy over why the labor movement in the United States has been so much smaller than that in other comparable liberal democracies. And the solution that a couple of scholars had pointed to was judicial review, that essentially Congress during the Wilson administration had tried to protect labor organizing, but the Supreme Court had struck down or gutted those laws, and it was the presence of judicial review that caused things to develop differently. Well, George, you know, took a look at the legislation that was ostensibly supposed to protect unions, and he found out that, you know, the first draft of the legislation would have very clear language limiting the ability of courts to issue injunctions, which is primarily what labor wanted, and every successive draft of the legislation would become vaguer and vaguer and more ambiguous, and ultimately actually expanded the power of the courts to issue injunctions when pretty much everybody understood what the federal courts were likely to do with that. So it's a little misleading to say that you had a pro-labor Congress and president and an anti-labor Supreme Court, and the anti-labor Supreme Court triumphed over the political branches. That, as in many other cases, the branches are more in cahoots necessarily than they are in zero-sum competition. I was teaching perhaps, you know, the most normatively and empirically sophisticated expression of this argument, Keith Whittington's fairly recent book on presidents and the Supreme Court. And we don't really have a school of thought for this. A colleague of mine suggested that we call ourselves the Political Construction of Judicial Power School, or PCP, which for some reason didn't really go over well, so I don't know. You know, if you think that the courts do this, you're on angel dust, I don't know, but didn't fly. But so we don't have a catchy name for this school, in part because a lot of the scholars involved sort of resist being part of any kind of school. But what's interesting about this is that Professor Whittington goes through and looks at all the ways in which the power of the courts has been increased willfully by Congress and the executive branch, the benefits that various presidents have gotten from judicial review, as well as the many times in which presidents have successfully challenged judicial authority. But after all this, Whittington uses this as an explanation for why the United States has judicial supremacy. So, you know, the title of Whittington's book is The Political Foundations of Judicial Supremacy. So despite being very conscious of the extent to which judicial power is politically constructed, Whittington ends up in the same place as the more conventional approaches, essentially assuming that, the courts have the final say over constitutional matters. And this sort of got me thinking about, you know, that there's some obvious tension here. that if judicial review is created by acts of Congress and the executive branch in large measure, which I'll come back to in a second, and if it serves the interests of political elites in various ways, what exactly does it mean to say that the courts are supreme or that they have the final say over constitutional questions? So I was thinking about whether we maybe should be pushing things a little further and take the insights of this school of thought and question whether we have judicial supremacy at all. And at the very least, I wanted to think about what exactly judicial supremacy means. So it's one of those terms that seems to have an obvious meaning, you know, judicial decision, interpretations of the Constitution are final, but we sort of need to put a little more meat on the bones to try to determine, well, there's a case of judicial review and the policy established by the court, you know, seems to stand, you know, how do we know that this is judicial supremacy rather than the court sort of doing the bidding of some other actor in the political system? So what I want to emphasize here based on the insights of the PCP school or whatever you want to call it, that not every case in which the courts announce a ruling and that ruling seems to establish policy is necessarily a case of judicial supremacy. It certainly can be. So in theory, if there's an act of judicial review and ultimately the policy established by the court is enduring, that could simply be the court imposing its will on the other political branches. But there are a couple of other things that could be happening as well. One of these, and I think a lot of rational choice scholarship has done a good job of identifying these, is the minority veto. So especially in the American case, there are often a variety of ways in which Congress may react to a judicial opinion in a way that can counteract it or substantially, you know, push back against the court, up to and including just outright jurisdiction stripping. But there are maybe cases in which a majority is prepared to enact legislation that would counteract what a court does, but it's stopped by some minority within the system or by, you know, a majority in one of the branches. So that, and this is something I'm going to return to in a second, but it's obviously very important to understand that in a separation of powers system, what comes out of Congress or what Congress doesn't do doesn't necessarily reflect the will of the majority. So although this is a statutory case, not a constitutional case, the classic example would be when the Supreme Court's Ledbetter decision, which sort of narrowly read a particular civil rights provision, as soon as that decision came down in the waning years of the Bush administration, a majority of the House of Representatives passed legislation that would have changed the law to reflect the understanding of the dissenters, and a majority of the Senate was prepared to vote for it, but it was filibustered to death, and President Bush had threatened to veto it. So in that case, the policy established by the Supreme Court, you know, temporarily held fast, but not necessarily because of majority opposition, but because the institutional mechanisms of American politics in some cases allow a minority to stop a majority from doing something. So we have to be careful that often that Supreme Court opinions may endure because of, you know, various other parts of the political system, which, as I said, is a point I'm going to return to in a second. But there's another important thing that can happen here, which is what Professor Lovell and I call a legislative default, which is that some coalition of legislators who support what the court has just done and legislators who don't particularly care what policy is established as long as they don't have to deal with it can often work to sustain a judicial opinion. There are various cases such as, you know, the Citizens United case might be an example of this, where there are various ways that Congress could react to the Citizens United decision in ways that would, you know, restrict the role of money in campaigns, whether by creating public financing or, you know, there's various other loopholes, but Congress hasn't reacted at all. And I suspect that's in part because the legislative majorities that passed that legislation may not have been very strongly committed to it. President Bush had actually threatened to veto the legislation, the McCain-Feingold Act, and I suspect that he signed it in part expecting the Supreme Court to strike it down and was surprised when it initially didn't. So there's a possibility that we always have to remember, you know, this takes us back to David Mayhew, but that legislators may not have particularly strong policy views on all questions. So that, you know, if you're a, you know, pro-life member of Congress from a relatively affluent, socially liberal suburban district, the Supreme Court taking the abortion issue off your hands is actually quite politically beneficial. You know, you can say, well, I'd love to pass anti-abortion legislation, but the court has tied my hands, sorry. Whereas you can tell your pro-choice but economically conservative constituents, well, don't worry about it. We can't do anything. The Supreme Court will strike it down. So often, you know, there are political benefits from letting the courts resolve contested policy questions, just as there are political benefits from for the legislature to let the executive branch make various difficult decisions when it applies legislation and so on. And there's a final possibility here that we should consider, which is simply convergence. That is that there are cases in which the court strikes down an act of legislation, but is almost certainly acting consistently with the preferences of a majority of legislatures and a majority of the population. I would say the Supreme Court's 1965 decision, Griswold versus Connecticut, which struck down a law banning the distribution or use of contraception, was almost certainly a case of that. There's no way that if that law didn't exist, the Connecticut legislature in 1965 would have passed it. It certainly didn't have majority support of the population. It was an example of sort of, you know, there's a powerful minority within the state that made it politically unattractive to change the legislation. And essentially, the only people affected by the legislation directly were a relatively less powerful group of people who needed subsidized contraception. So it was one of those things where status quo bias may have kept a law on the books, but when the Supreme Court acted to strike it down, it's extraordinarily unlikely that this was inconsistent with the policy preferences of a majority of legislators. Now, as I'm going to be coming back to in my workshop tomorrow, I don't mean to suggest that this is unproblematic from a democratic theory perspective. There is something disturbing about legislators sort of letting the courts take the heat for various political decisions. So the democratic problem in these cases may not be the courts usurping the will of the legislature, but there are problems with this kind of devolution of responsibility that that can arise. So I say this not to say that, well, this solves all the problems that judicial review might pose for democratic theory, but simply to point out that we can't assume that because the courts issue a decision and the decision ends up being sustained, that they're therefore imposing their will on political elites or some other kind of majority. That we have to sort of look at things on a case-by-case basis and try to figure out what exactly is going on. And so the next thing that we need, if we're going to figure out, well, what's a case of judicial supremacy, I sort of propose that there are sort of three conditions that would seem to be in some way necessary if we're going to call something judicial supremacy. So that if there's a standpoint where, you know, again, a situation where the courts strike down a law or issue a judgment, and this judgment ends up setting policy, I think there are sort of three conditions that on at least some level need to be fulfilled before we can say that that's judicial supremacy as opposed to something more complicated. The first, coming back to what I just said, is that there has to be a genuine conflict. So that if the courts and current legislative majorities agree, then there's not really a relevant conflict between the branches. So if the courts can set policy because the other relevant actors agree with them, that doesn't mean that the courts aren't exercising power, but I'm not sure that judicial supremacy is the best way of thinking about that. And again, that when the courts and the political branches are in cahoots, that is a matter of concern, but judicial supremacy is not the best way of describing that relationship. I would say the second thing that you would need for there to be judicial supremacy is enforcement. That is, if the courts issue an opinion that theoretically remains good law, but nobody actually obeys it, then again, that's hard to call that judicial supremacy. So that judicial supremacy implies that at least to some degree, other political actors make a good faith effort to follow the law. So if the Supreme Court hands down an opinion arguing that mandatory school prayer is unconstitutional and various school districts continue to do that and nothing happens, then we don't really have a case of judicial supremacy there. You know, what we have is the court said something and other political actors ignored it and nothing happened. And then finally, I think that another element of judicial supremacy is that judicial opinions have to have some level of normative authority. So the most extreme example of this would be, you know, the great legal theorist Robert Cover talks about the role of the courts as being jurispathic. That is, there are all kinds of different, you know, moral and legal and political traditions, and one thing the courts do in some cases is to say, this is the one we're going with as opposed to the others, to sort of, you know, settle these normative conflicts in society and point us in one direction. Now, and I should say that this is true for, you know, all three of these categories, that they're meant to be suggestive heuristics rather than sort of ideal types. So, or I should say ideal types rather than, you know, really strict criteria. So it would be trivially easy to disprove judicial supremacy by pointing out that there's some gap in enforcement or that somebody disagrees with the Supreme Court decision, but, you know, that's not really very interesting. So I don't mean to say that, you know, any slippage here is enough to say that something isn't judicial supremacy, but at the very least, I think that we have to see the courts substantially changing things. So I don't think anybody expects when the courts hand out a decision that everybody is immediately going to agree with it, but we should at least see, at least, you know, according to this, the court creating some movement in the direction of the court's belief. So the court having some ability to change public opinion or lessen the tenor of opposition or something like that. And the same thing with enforcement. There are always gaps in enforcement, no matter what branch we're talking about. But if judicial decisions are just wildly flouted, then again, I don't think judicial supremacy is the right way of characterizing this. So, you know, and I'm definitely happy for input if you think that, you know, one of these criteria is invalid or if anybody has another idea. But I think sort of, you know, going back through the literature, I think that these are three criteria that virtually everybody can agree on, that in some level, judicial supremacy, and it may not mean all three of these things, but it means, you know, some combination of these things have to be going on for there to be judicial supremacy as the correct way of evaluating the relationship. Now, there's a very important conceptual point here, which is that we also have to be careful not to confuse judicial supremacy with the fact that the American political system simply gives a lot of power to veto players. And so I want to point out that that there are many, you know, cases in which, in fact, the constitutional interpretation of the judiciary clearly doesn't prevail over the constitutional views of other branches. And this is simply because the judiciary clearly isn't necessarily supreme if it says, yes, something is constitutional. So I have this extremely sophisticated chart showing off my PowerPoint chops here to sort of illustrate this. But so let me do some comparisons. So, you know, a classic example of what looks like judicial supremacy would be the court's recent decision in Shelby County striking down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which required certain jurisdictions with a history of discrimination to get approval from the Department of Justice before they changed their voting laws. So the court struck down Section 4. Having read the decision several times, I'm still not sure what was unconstitutional about the law, but at any rate, the decision came down. Although, again, I would point out that, at least in theory, the Roberts Court did not prevent Congress from passing any kind of preclearance requirement. So Chief Justice Roberts did not say that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which theoretically permitted preclearance, was unconstitutional. So even there, the court left some room for Congress to act. And if Congress doesn't act, then that suggests that there's something else going on other than judicial supremacy. But at any rate, leaving that little bit of slippage aside, there's a situation in which, you know, Congress overwhelmingly passed the Voting Rights Act, although I think we're about to see that the extent of the majority was perhaps misleading. The president signed the legislation, and the Supreme Court said no, and the result is that Section 4 is no longer applicable. So that's your sort of classic, you know, judicial supremacy-sounding situation. But let's go all the way back to the 19th century and consider another case, which is, of course, Andrew Jackson's famous veto of the rechartering of the National Bank in 1831 and 1832. Well, what happened there was that Congress, you know, passed legislation rechartering the National Bank. And they didn't actually have to do it at that time, but they thought it would be a promising election issue to sort of force President Jackson to either veto the bank or to go along with authorizing it. And Jackson ended up vetoing it. And this was a time in which the strong norm was that presidents should not veto legislation solely on policy grounds, but only if they believe that the legislation exceeded the valid powers of Congress or the valid powers of the federal government. Now, again, as is true when courts evaluate constitutional issues, I'm not saying that policy considerations were entirely absent from these deliberations, but at least explicitly, and you can see this in President Jackson's veto message, constitutional issues were a very major part of why he vetoed this legislation. Well, at the time, Chief Justice Marshall, who in the landmark decision of McCulloch versus Maryland had argued that the National Bank was constitutional, was still on, still serving as Chief Justice with a majority of the Supreme Court. So the bank veto was a situation in which Congress believed the National Bank was constitutional, the Supreme Court believed that the National Bank was unconstitutional, but the National Bank didn't pass because President Jackson didn't believe it was unconstitutional. So this is a case in which the Supreme Court's constitutional interpretation didn't prevail, but I don't think anybody would, at least today, describe this as a case of presidential supremacy over constitutional interpretation. You might have actually gotten some purchase with that in the 19th century, but I think we would understand that this doesn't necessarily say anything about the fixed institutional powers of the branches to interpret the Constitution. It's just that the American political system gives more power to anybody who says no than to people who say yes. You need, some degree of unanimity among a lot of veto players. And then finally, let me propose an alternative scenario, which is that in early 2010, Republicans have 41 or 42 seats in the Senate rather than 40. Well, what almost certainly would have happened in that case, and again, let's pretend that the sole objections of Republican senators to the mandate was a constitutional one, which is obviously misleading, but just hypothetically, what would have happened in that case is that the president believed that the mandate was constitutional. A majority of the Supreme Court believed that the mandate was constitutional, but it would not have passed because a minority of one of the branches believed it was unconstitutional. So despite the fact that the House had passed it and a majority of the Senate had voted for it, currently, in some cases, 40 senators can be enough to have their interpretation prevail. Now, again, I don't think had that happened, we would look at that and describe that as a case of, Senate minority supremacy. Although I would argue that Senate minorities under the current filibuster rules probably, have a greater influence over public policy in the United States than the Supreme Court does. At least it's arguable. So that it's very important to keep this in mind here, that what looks like judicial supremacy or kind of some sort of exclusive power of interpreting the Constitution, we may be confusing that with the fact that the United States empowers all veto players. So that the courts are no different than anybody else, that two people saying yes and one person saying no is always no, regardless of who gives the no. The Canadian cases, of course, with a Westminster system is much more complicated, which I'll return to, which makes the question of why the Canadian courts have achieved a level of power comparable to the American ones even more interesting. But so anyway, so that's one thing that I think is worth being conceptually clear about. So what I just proceeded to do from there then was to sort of look at what would be, from my perspective, a series of hard cases. So there's obviously no way in a 40-page paper that I can look at everything the Supreme Court has been doing for 200 years and make a large-end study and ask whether we have judicial supremacy or not. But I thought I would at least start off by looking at a few cases that are most commonly associated with judicial supremacy and looking into it and say, how well do they fit into the criteria that I've laid out? Now, again, of course, looking at these cases cannot prove that there aren't other examples that would fit the model. So I'm not arguing that cases that fit the basic judicial supremacy framework never happen, only at a minimum that we shouldn't necessarily assume that and that we should start wondering about whether there are better ways of thinking about judicial power. Now, as kind of a prelude, one can start off with Marbury versus Madison. And when I bring up this case, basically for about half the people in the room, I'll be saying too much, and half I'll be saying not enough. But to try to split the difference here, obviously that, if we're trying to figure out why the Canadian Supreme Court has the power of judicial review since 1982, we just have to look to Section 24 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which explicitly gives the courts the remedy in most cases or gives courts the right to give remedies to violations of constitutional rights. As many of you know, there's no provision of the United States Constitution that explicitly grants the power of judicial review. Well, in not only in civics textbooks, but in documentaries about the court, and even often in legal case books or legal scholarship, the way in which the emergence of judicial review in the United States is generally told is that there's no explicit power of judicial review in the Constitution, but John Marshall created it with the Marbury versus Madison decision of 1803, which is the first time that the Supreme Court declared an act of Congress unconstitutional. Now, the basic, and again, apologies for those of you who have heard this too many times, but the basic backstory of Marbury versus Madison was that in the early 1801, the lame duck Adams administration made a huge series of appointments to the federal courts, essentially trying to preserve the Federalist control of the courts at a time in which the Jeffersonians had taken over the rest of the government. Needless to say, Jefferson did not think very highly of these lame duck appointments, who one of whom, incidentally, was the new Chief Justice John Marshall. And when Jefferson took over, there were a series of judicial appointments that had been confirmed by the Senate but were still on the desk of the Secretary of State, who, ironically enough, was also John Marshall. So really shouldn't have heard this case, but that's another story. So what happened was, essentially, was that Jefferson told his new Secretary of State, James Madison, not to deliver the appointments that had not already been delivered, a sort of a way of sort of expressing his discontent with the sort of court packing that the Federalists did after Adams had lost the election. So a guy named William Marbury, who had been appointed to Justice of the Peace in the District of Columbia, sued to get his judgeship. The Jeffersonians canceled the Supreme Court term of 1802, which should show you something about the political background there. And in 1803, the Supreme Court finally heard Marbury's case. And what Chief Justice Marshall did was to argue that Jefferson had acted illegally, that Marbury was entitled to his appointment, but that he had no remedy in the Supreme Court because when Congress had given the Supreme Court the power to issue the relevant writ, it had exceeded its authority. So, you know, the act of judicial review is used so that, you know, Marshall can say that Jefferson acted illegally without issuing an order that he was certain that Madison and Jefferson would not have obeyed. So that essentially the argument here is that by the strategically clever move, Marshall was able to sort of create the power of judicial review without exposing the court to immediate political retaliation, and this is what led to the establishment of judicial review. Now, the revisionists that I talked about earlier have pointed out that the idea that Marbury established the power of judicial review is a little bit odd. So Marshall said in Marbury that, you know, it is emphatically the duty of the Supreme Court to say what the law is. But as one scholar notes, I can say it is emphatically the duty of Scott Lemieux to say what the law is. But if it doesn't command authority for any other political actor, it's not very useful. And so what's interesting about this case is that, you know, Marshall deliberately avoided getting his own preference about how the case should be resolved, that he used the power of judicial review to restrict his own power. So that's a form of judicial review, but not a very interesting or politically meaningful form of judicial review. That judicial review only really matters if the courts can order people who don't want to do what the court wants to do something. You know, if the courts just use judicial review to restrict their own power, it's not very interesting, and it certainly isn't anything like judicial supremacy. And another interesting thing about Marbury is that this weird narrative in which Marbury is seen as sort of causing the rise of judicial review runs into obvious problems in that Marbury was essentially never cited by the United States Supreme Court until well after the power of judicial review was fairly well established. So that, you know, the sort of courts in the late 19th century began to cite Marbury when judicial review became politically contested during the Progressive Era. But it's sort of, you know, Marbury is only a landmark after the fact, that nobody at the time believed that Marbury caused the rise of judicial review, which had much more to do with acts of Congress expanding jurisdiction and just the general preference of the Republican governments at that time to have the courts play a greater role in economic development and so on. So now one particularly curious thing about Marbury is that when you get down to the evaluation of the case itself, there's really no difference between how the revisionists see the case and the canonical take on the case. Everybody agrees that Marshall acted strategically. Virtually everybody agrees that Marshall did not sincerely believe that the section of the Judiciary Act was unconstitutional, that he exercised judicial review to avoid a power struggle that he was going to certainly lose. And another important piece of the context of Marbury is that the very next week, the Supreme Court allowed the Jeffersonians to completely eliminate all of the circuit courts that had been created by the Federalists before Adams left office, which seems to be a much greater threat to judicial power. And the courts just let that go, even though we know a majority of the court believed that was unconstitutional, essentially just getting out of the way. And that was essentially how the Marshall Court always worked. It never again struck down an act of Congress. And it generally only struck down state laws when a majority of the government at the time wanted those same state laws struck down. So another thing you'll notice about the Marshall Court is that they were much more aggressive when there were moderate Jeffersonians like Madison and John Quincy Adams in power than they were when Jefferson or Jackson was in charge. So really, that Marbury, if any, so that it's not that the revisionists have a different take on Marbury so much as that they push it to their to its logical extreme. That if all judicial review means is, the courts can take away their own power, but they can't really force anybody to do anything, that's not very relevant. So to the extent that judicial review has actually allowed the courts to order other branches to do something they don't want to do, that had to emerge well after Marbury, and Marbury can't be the source of it. So that's sort of one, bit of background there. And given the extent to which Marbury is now being cited by the Supreme Court as establishing judicial supremacy, which I don't think it did even in its text, we should keep that in the back of our minds. Now, the first hard case that I'm going to look at is Cooper versus Aaron, which, of course, is famous as up to that time, the strongest argument that the Supreme Court had made asserting judicial supremacy. And most of you will know the background of this case. In the aftermath of Brown versus Board of Education, most of the governments in the southern states were resisting Brown versus Board of Education, and there was a major crisis in Little Rock, Arkansas, when the governor used various tactics to evade the Supreme Court. And Arkansas courts essentially agreed with the local school boards that they did not have to comply with Brown versus Board immediately. Eventually, Dwight Eisenhower had to send the Screaming Eagles into Little Rock to try to enforce the decision. Well, the case came to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court issued a very unusual jointly signed opinion asserting that the court had the exclusive ability to interpret the Constitution. And, in the famous language of the opinion, it also attributed this, again, very misleadingly, to Marbury versus Madison, that according to the joint opinion, Marbury declared the basic principle that the federal judiciary is supreme in the exposition of the law of the Constitution, and that principle has ever since been respected by this court and the country as a permanent and indispensable feature of our constitutional system. Now, it seems to me that, that looking at this in retrospect, it's stated in such a way to almost seem to be protesting too much, that this sounds like it's coming from a position of weakness as much as a position of strength. And I think that that's, actually the case. That if you think about Cooper versus Aaron, it would be a very odd example of judicial supremacy in practice. Almost every Southern member of Congress, as most of you know, passed an opinion in the wake of Brown versus Board of Education, arguing that the decision was wrong and did not have to be obeyed. And Cooper versus Aaron certainly didn't change anybody's mind. And as most of you know, there was essentially no desegregation in the Deep South at all until the Civil Rights Act of 1964 put some federal enforcement muscle and some federal tax money behind it. So this graph comes from Gerald Rosenberg's classic book, The Hollow Hope, a sort of skeptical look at the effect of judicial review. And you can see that essentially no African Americans were going to school with whites in the Deep South in 1954. And 10 years later, there were literally less than 100 in the entire Deep South. So that that does not seem like a Supreme Court that is getting its way in policy terms, that the decision was widely and very successfully resisted until Congress decided to intervene. Now, there is one thing I want to note here, because I'm going to return to it in the conclusion. To make a very unoriginal observation about Rosenberg, you'll note here that this is solely looking at schools in the Deep South. And Rosenberg doesn't have any fancy graph looking at integration in the border states, where you would actually see the Supreme Court's opinion actually having a measurable effect. Now, this is because the way Rosenberg thinks about judicial power is that the judiciary is only really enacting meaningful authority if it's able to get its opinions enforced over the opposition of every other relevant political actor. That essentially, judicial power means a very strong form of judicial independence, which can be associated with judicial supremacy. What I'm going to argue is that I agree with Rosenberg 100% that The courts are very unlikely to prevail in a real power struggle between the other branches, but I don't think that's the right question. That in many cases, the courts are siding in a policy dispute where we'll have some allies, but not uniform support, and it strikes me that in those cases, the courts can have a very substantial policy impact. It's just that the strongest vision of judicial independence or judicial supremacy are not the right way to think about that. So I'm just putting that in the back of your minds because we're going to come back to that at the conclusion. So, but at any rate, certainly in the Brutist form, Cooper versus Aaron would be very odd as an example of judicial supremacy because of the problems with enforcement and the problems with normative authority, that essentially nobody who didn't already agree with the court was persuaded by Cooper versus Aaron. Now, the second case, which may seem stronger, was a decision by the Rehnquist Court called City of Burnie versus Flores. And the background of this case is that in 1990, the Supreme Court substantially narrowed the way in which it evaluated the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. And I'm actually the only person outside the Supreme Court who thinks that Justice Scalia's opinion was right in that case, although I think I'm about to get a whole bunch of new allies soon, depending on what the Supreme Court does. But at any rate, my opinion was certainly not shared by vast majorities of Congress. So in 1993, Congress passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which passed 97-3 in the Senate and unanimously in the House of Representatives, attempting to restore the old constitutional standard that the court had effectively overruled in 1990. So essentially you had a strange bedfellows coalition of civil libertarians and Christian conservatives who strongly opposed what the court had done. Well, there was an obscure zoning case in Texas which came up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that at least that part of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was unconstitutional. And that's a particularly interesting case because we had here a case where Congress was trying to give more rights to a minority than the Supreme Court was declaring was necessary. So that seems like a particularly troubling use of judicial review, that when legislators want to give more protection to minorities, it seems odd to read the Constitution in a way that prevents that. But nonetheless, in Justice Kennedy's language, and it's sort of appropriate that this opinion comes from Justice Kennedy, who's kind of most commonly identified with the kind of overweening court, in part because while he's sort of predominantly conservative, he's a little heterodox or liberal curious or however you want to put it, but he sort of issues a variety of opinions across the political spectrum, but he seems to have a very high opinion of the ability of courts to resolve social disputes. And Justice Kennedy said that if Congress could define its own powers by altering the 14th Amendment's meaning, no longer would the Constitution be superior paramount law, unchangeable by ordinary means. And he went on to say that to allow Congress to pass this legislation would essentially be curtailing the amendment procedures set out by Article 5 of the Constitution. Now, you all see Kennedy's move here, which is a classic theoretical judicial supremacy move, that he's identifying the meaning of the Constitution with what the Supreme Court says about it. So that it's not that Congress and the Supreme Court disagree about what the Constitution means, it's that the Supreme Court has fixed the meaning of the Constitution and Congress is trying to alter that. So in theory, this seems like a classic example of judicial supremacy. But again, I would point out two sort of obvious holes in this. The first is that this whole sequence of cases presents a really huge normative authority problem, in that the Supreme Court issued a judgment about the Constitution, and essentially every member of Congress publicly passed legislation disagreeing with it. So certainly, this doesn't show that Supreme Court judges about the Constitution carry some sort of inherent normative weight with other political elites. It was rejected about as unanimously as is possible to do under modern political conditions. But there's another, and I think that in and of itself I don't think would be the decisive factor. What really strikes me as decisive here is that if you think about it for a second, the Supreme Court's judgment in this case is not forcing any level of government, state or federal, to do anything. So if state and federal legislators are committed to the vision of religious freedom that the Supreme Court had held before 1990, it's simply free to interpret the First Amendment that way when it passes legislation. So all the Supreme Court is saying here is that state and local governments are not required to read the First Amendment in a sort of broader way, but nothing prevents them from doing so. So it seems to me that what's going on here is not necessarily the courts forcing other branches to do something they don't want. It's just that there's sort of a tension between everybody's in favor of religious freedom, but not everybody necessarily conceptualizes that as we cannot ask churches to comply with generally applicable zoning laws, as is the case in this case. So I'm not sure that City of Burnie, although it's sort of an attractive case in some ways, really clinches the case for judicial supremacy, because to have a really good example of judicial supremacy, we need to have the courts ordering the other branches to actually do something, as opposed to the courts saying that the branches don't have to do something, which strikes me as different. And then, of course, there's, you know, the final potential case here is Bush versus Gore, which is often comes up, and of course, Ron Herschel's excellent book Towards Juristocracy makes a great deal of Bush versus Gore, that, you know, if you're going to use a symbol of judicial supremacy and judicial power, Bush versus Gore seems like the ultimate one. Now, literally, the Supreme Court is able to resolve the results of a presidential election. And this certainly wasn't because the court persuaded anybody who didn't already, favor President Bush, or persuaded very few people, I should say, that the decision was correct. That essentially that, you know, although Vice President Gore disagreed with the opinion, he simply agreed to comply with it. So this seems like a sort of, you know, classic example of the courts imposing their will on other branches with the highest stakes imaginable. Except that, as, you know, of course, the unsigned opinion said, that the problem of equal protection presents many complexities, which means that it's not clear how the case will be applied going forward. But I would say that if we look back at this case, we see things, that make me wonder if judicial supremacy is the right way of talking about it. To borrow a point made by both Howard Gilman and Lee Epstein, if you think about it, there are two branches that had the possibility to react against the Supreme Court in this case. So that if there's a dispute about the Electoral College, it's first resolved at the level of the Florida legislature and executive, because, you know, Florida would have to decide if it wanted to send a second set of electors or not. And then ultimately it would be up to Congress to determine which set of electors was valid. Well, of course, the state of Florida at that time was not only controlled by the Republican Party, but literally the governor was the brother of President-elect Bush. So I think we could very safely say that the political elites in Florida did not have a problem with what the Supreme Court was doing. And had Florida sent a second set of electors, the determination over which ones to count would have been made by the House of Representatives, which again was controlled by the Republican Party. So that the only two institutions with a chance to actually do anything about Bush versus Gore both strongly supported what the courts were doing. So again, that sounds like a collaboration. That doesn't sound like a struggle between various political branches. That the relevant decision-making bodies were all composed of people who strongly agreed with how the courts resolved the case. You know, had the Supreme Court resolved the issue in favor of Gore in the way that led to a recount with Gore ahead and gotten that to stick, I would buy that as an example of judicial supremacy, but I'm not sure that would have happened. Now, the good news for me is that since it didn't happen, I can speculate freely about what would have happened or not, and I can't be disproven. So that's always nice as a social scientist when you have an unfalsifiable claim. So I should say that I'm not claiming that. It is possible that had the Supreme Court resolve the decision in favor of Gore and the particular recount that was set up led to Gore winning, that Gore would have become president, but I'm not sure that we can count on that. I think it's very possible that the state of Florida would have set an alternate state of electors to Congress, and Congress would have selected the Bush electors, seeing the actions of the Florida court as being illegitimate. We at least don't know that's the case. So, you know, so that again, it seems to me here that, that Bush versus Gore was sort of, you know, the Supreme Court might have ratified something, but it ratified something that was probably going to happen one way or the other, because all of the relevant decision-making bodies were controlled by pro-Bush forces. So again, although it seems superficially as if Bush versus Gore is an example of judicial supremacy, I'm not so sure about that, simply because there just isn't the meaningful opposition that would be necessary. So my conclusion here, and you might argue that the candidate on the title sheet was sort of tacked on, and I think you'd be accurate, but I did want to come back to the Canadian case just to point out here that there can be, you know, both sort of normative and empirical value from decoupling judicial power from judicial supremacy. And again, I want to make very clear here that in saying that I'm skeptical that judicial supremacy is the best way of describing what the courts do, that doesn't mean that the courts don't have a substantial amount of power. That again, that the reality of a political system is that, you know, you have factions on either side, and when the Supreme Court changes a policy baseline in favor of one rather than the other, this has a major effect on policy. So it may be true that Roe versus Wade has been sustained in part because it has a lot of political support throughout the system, but that doesn't make the decision inconsequential. And that's where I disagree with the way that people like Rosenberg think about the courts, that in picking one side over the other, the court has power. It's just that it's not exactly imposing its will on the other branches so much as working with one side rather than the other. And one thing this can do is to help us explain the even more interesting, in some ways, Canadian case, and that the Canadian Constitution, of course, formally has coordinate interpretation, that Section 33 gives simple majorities of both Parliament and provincial legislatures the power to override Supreme Court decisions for 5 years in most cases, and yet, as Dean Manfredi has pointed out in persuasive detail, outside the unusual context of secessionist governments in Quebec and a couple of other minor exceptions, Section 33 is essentially a dead letter, which seems odd that, you know, so that basically, in practice, Canada has judicial supremacy to whatever extent the United States has judicial supremacy. But that should get us thinking again about, is judicial supremacy, therefore, really the right way of thinking about this? If political elites who have the formal tools to override the courts don't use these tools, whether for ideological reasons or for practical reasons or whatever, you know, should we be thinking about judicial power in a different way? That it's not a zero-sum struggle between the branches, but it's a power that exists because it's strongly in the interests of various political elites who, even if they might disagree with individual decisions, believe that, again, whether, you know, it's consistent with their values or consistent with their political interests or some combination, believe that there's a benefit from judicial review. So I think that decoupling judicial supremacy from judicial power can not only help us better understand the American case, but I think will also have a lot of applicability in comparative context as well, and will also, you know, as I think a better, you know, opens up better avenues to thinking about judicial power and thinking about its democratic legitimacy. So I think I've said enough, and we've got a great crowd here, so I'll open it up for questions there. But thank you very much.
It is our custom that the first question at the lectures be reserved for a member of the Research Group on Constitutional Studies Student Fellowship.
The argument was just too persuasive. I just don't have no dissenters. I know that's not true.
At the risk of oversimplification of a complex paper, it seems to me you're suggesting the question of judicial supremacy is largely irrelevant. It's more a rhetorical question than anything else, because in actual practice, it is its context and political process that really explains the workings of the court and its decision-making. There's much to be said for that argument, but the question is there any value about discussing the theoretical question anyway, even if it's overstated, even if it is dependent upon context? Is there something to be gained by having the debate, even if it's somewhat exaggerated, is the question.
I think certainly that's possible. I would never want to foreclose any sort of avenue of theoretical inquiry, and I can certainly think that, you know, and for that matter, I know that a great deal of interesting work has been done by scholars to sort of take judicial supremacy as an empirical fact for granted and have gone from that. And whether that's, you know, Keith Whittington's more sort of empirical work or the normative work being done by people like Larry Kramer and Mark Tushnet, you know, I don't, so I certainly wouldn't disagree that there, you know, that thing of judicial supremacy as an idea certainly may, lead to some real theoretical insights. The debate may be worth having, but I feel that if we focus too much on judicial supremacy, that there may be other things that we're missing. That, and this is something I'm going to urge at the workshop again tomorrow, but that I think that there are times in which theoretical considerations of judicial review and its democratic legitimacy can be decoupled from the actual relationship between courts and legislatures in practice. And there are things that, you know, when people write about the courts, they'll often say things about legislatures that they would never make claims that they would never make in any other context. So nobody, for example, really thinks that the American legislative procedures are purely majoritarian, but that's an assumption that they're willing to one with in order to talk about the courts. And I would certainly not say that, that work is never valuable and that there are things to be gained from that. And you always have to oversimplify somewhere. You know, that we can't get anywhere in any kind of social science if we're not willing to generalize, and so we have to pick. So I'm not suggesting that all that work be thrown out and that people not pursue that, but I at least want to suggest, say, opening up another line that maybe that this we should do at least some work with this not being the generalization we want to go with, to sort of think about judicial power rather than thinking about judicial supremacy or the strongest forms of judicial independence. But I think you make a good point that that's not to say that there's never any value in thinking about judicial independence as an ideal type. And again, particularly, my conclusions here are necessarily tentative. I mean, you know, people may come up with, you know, 7 or 8 cases that are just locked down, no questions asked, examples of judicial supremacy, and then that would give a theoretical interest. So I'm not making a really strong claim that it's never a useful description, just that we at least want to start thinking about it. So that would be the other thing I would say, is that I wouldn't be willing to go that far, in part because I don't think that I've proven my case so much as made a suggestive one.
Just for clarification, to add one other point, particularly in Canada, the argument about the activism of the Supreme Court has often come up with cases involving human rights. And so, as a special area, and I'm wondering if you have any opinion on that question, that if we stop the theoretical argument about what the court can or cannot do, or should or should not do, do you think it will affect? I mean, admittedly, this is a rhetorical kind of question, but once you're up there, I'm taking advantage of it.
Of course. Whether
you think that it could have a practical effect by changing the kind of debates that go on as to what the role of law in the society should be.
Right. Well, and I think that's, you know, so that there's one argument that's sort of, you know, one way of framing judicial supremacy is that it's sort of a useful myth. That is, that the idea that the courts are supreme may have benefits in terms of the Supreme Court's ability to defend the rights of unpopular minorities or so on. And again, this is something that, you know, please come to the workshop tomorrow because I'm going to be addressing that more directly. The nickel version of that argument is that I'm a little bit skeptical, just because, so on the one hand, I don't worry so much about courts being able to just routinely impose their will on other political elites, because I think that that's often not what happens. But the flip side of that is that courts also aren't very reliable defenders of the rights of minorities. That generally, the courts are only willing generally to stand up for human rights when there's at least substantial support for human rights elsewhere in the system. So, you know, one scholar says that, you know, a generation of legal scholars has written about the Warren Court as if Barry Goldwater won a huge landslide in 1964. That when the Warren Court was expanding, you know, its rights jurisprudence, that was a time in which the entire national government was strongly in favor. So even though there were a few opinions, like on school prayer and on criminal procedure, where the court was acting in a way that opposed public opinion majorities, it wasn't acting against the policy preferences of the national government at the time. So that when there wasn't support for civil rights and civil liberties, like in the 19th century, the Supreme Court did not at all do a good job, and in fact, in some cases, struck down civil rights legislation. So I guess my bottom line is that the court is sort of overrated both as a hero and as a villain, in the sense that generally, if there are human rights protections or the protections of the rights of minorities, there's substantial support for that elsewhere in the political system. But on the other hand, there's this tendency to blame the courts for segregation or blame the courts for slavery. And again, that's very misleading. You know, the courts didn't really impose Dred Scott on the other branches. The other branches had spent years urging the Supreme Court to do exactly what it did in Dred Scott. I'd rather have Jean Drapeau, build another stadium than hire James Buchanan to do anything. So it's not a question of institutional competence. So that, you know, that part of what I'm saying here is that although the courts matter, they matter sort of at the margin. That is, that if you have two sort of relatively powerful, you know, political factions, they can have power by siding with one over the other. And that's a meaningful power. And there may be cases, and again, I think that when we're talking about, say, a 20th century constitutional text interpreted by a 21st century court, the bad history of the United States Supreme Court in the 19th century may not be relevant. So I don't want to suggest that this is always the case. But we should at least be careful about assuming that the courts are reliable protectors of the rights of unpopular minorities, that sometimes they don't protect minority rights because they side with factions, or they might side with minorities like slaveholders or, you know, people who want to hire 8-year-olds to work in coal mines, which are minorities but not necessarily normally the attractive ones, or minorities that are underrepresented in the political system. So, you know, so I think that's a possibility that I wouldn't want to dismiss, but I would say that the history of judicial review should add some caution. So that when I say that the courts and legislatures are in cahoots, that's good news for democratic theory in one way, but also bad news for the other way of looking at it, which is the courts standing up for unpopular minorities. They do that sometimes, but not nearly as reliably as you might think. And of course, the question of what is, you know, what human rights are and who should be protected are in themselves matters of political contestation. They're not, you know, it's not always self-evident what exactly is, you know, human rights or the values of the Charter require, which is precisely why the court disagrees about them too. So again, I don't mean to, I hope that doesn't sound cavalier, because I think that's a real concern, but I would say that we should be careful about assuming that the courts are reliable protectors of important human rights.
Failing any other hands, I'll take a turn. There's a standard difference between the way political scientists and the way constitutional law scholars talk about some of these questions. And in talking in the way that political scientists talk, the language not only of veto points but of policy preferences, I wonder whether you've tilted the playing field a little. The idea of judicial supremacy, as standardly expressed, is not that the judiciary gets to be supreme in its policy preferences across the whole policy terrain, but rather that the judiciary gets to be supreme on questions of constitutional meaning. One problem is whether we as political scientists can get any empirical traction on the difference between constitutional meaning and policy preferences. But if we can, I wonder whether you think that judicial supremacy as an observational hypothesis has more to be said for it on the more narrowly defined scope of constitutional meaning. In particular, I'm struck that in order to get a case of rival departmentalist veto points on constitutional meaning, you have to go back to 1832. One of the claims made by the people who think that judicial supremacy is a useful way to describe things is that the judicial monopoly over claims of constitutional interpretation mean that as time goes on, the judiciary is the only veto player whose veto in the name of constitutional meaning seems to have legitimacy within the system. Not only in the American context where there's a straightforward sense that, well, they get to win because they're final. But even in a context such as Canada, where there are, in principle, alternatives available, but those alternatives seem to become normatively illegitimate. It's hard for actors, especially it's hard for actors outside Quebec, to get perceived legitimacy from use of the notwithstanding clause. And so the judiciary's claim that it has supremacy over the question of constitutional meaning comes to take over.
I think there's a lot to be said for that. That, you know, I could be, you know, again, by defining this the way political scientists think about it, I should say that I don't, you know, I shouldn't mean to apply, and I should just clarify for everybody that departmentalism is sort of the term used for the idea that particularly in the American context, that there's coordinate constitutional interpretation. So Winnington's argument is that if you look at the reconstructive presidents who kind of start a political order, they've all had various conflicts with the court, from Jefferson to Reagan and Jackson, Lincoln, of course, and FDR, all in various ways engaged in power struggles with the court. You know, and again, like everything about presidential power, they certainly become less over time. So you go from Jefferson, you know, literally just canceling newly created circuit courts, to Reagan, you know, issuing amicus briefs arguing that Roe versus Wade is wrong, but not arguing that they should be defied. They're obviously not comparable. Now, I should say that I certainly could come up with more recent examples. Maybe the best example is Lincoln arguing at the time that Dred Scott was only binding on the parties and not for them, and as soon as he was elected, putting that into practice. So he ignored his attorney general immediately, you know, gave citizenship right to African Americans, you know, the Congress immediately passed legislation banning slavery in the territories, and then, of course, it was the decision so nice it had to be overruled by constitutional amendments twice. So I think we'd say that Dred Scott did not work as judicial supremacy. That, and I think the White House won on that one. But there's a difficulty here, and I think that's a fair point, except that there's one issue here, which is that when the courts are more civil libertarian than the other branches, they don't have a chance to act. So that, or if all the branches are committed to free speech rights, there's no judicial decision to be done. So that's one problem here, is that when the courts say yes, we often don't know, you know, given the American system in which you can't ask a constitutional opinion until there's a case. One problem with coming up with 20th century examples of my clever graph there is that simply if the courts say yes and somebody else says no, we don't know what the courts think. So we just happen to know in Marshall's case that he said yes on the bank veto. It's often a little bit more complicated because the coalitions of the court change. We don't know what would happen absent a veto. And as you point out, that, you know, vetoes now can be done explicitly on policy grounds, so that it's very difficult, so that, you know, my stylized ACA example would assume that the only objection to the mandate was constitutional, when in fact, obviously, it was a mix of constitutional and policy concerns. But I would say, though, that that is still a problem, that if the courts think that something is constitutional, they still don't prevail over anybody who at least has constitutional concerns. Now, I think you can still make an argument that, you know, that there is something unique about the judicial no that carries more weight, and I'm certainly not opposed to that. You know, I really want to emphasize my tentativeness here, that I think that there may be something to that, but at least I want us to be a little more careful about seeing the evidence for that. So I bet that there probably are good cases of that, but I went through all these cases that you would think would show that, and I don't see it. But I do think that that's right, that from a constitutional perspective, we shouldn't discount, and I think that gets to the question here, too, that there is, you know, that they're all veto players, but there's still something about a judicial no. The fact that you know, the presidents used to have to speak in constitutional language and now can speak solely on policy language, that matters. I wouldn't discount that. So I think that's an important qualification. So absolutely. Hopefully that answered every answer.
Well, actually, Jacob sort of asked the question I was going to ask, which was whether you weren't, you can make a distinction between judicial policy supremacy and judicial interpretive supremacy. And I wanted to push you on that with the Canadian case at the very end. When you were talking about Section 33, you described it as a section that allows simple majorities of either the national or provincial legislatures to override decisions of the Supreme Court, which means that you were listening back in the 1990s when you were in those classes.
Right.
but of course, that's not the way the section is written, right? And it's not the way in which it has come to be commonly understood. And one way you can understand it, its common understanding, is in 1982 or 1987, I forget which anniversary of the Charter, Heritage Canada put out a nice booklet on the Charter of Rights. It was a nicely printed copy of the Charter and a series of questions for citizens, answering questions for citizens. And one of the questions, common questions of citizens, was, can the government take away my rights? And then the answer from Heritage Canada was, well, they talked about the limitations clause in Section 1, and then he said, and then there's Section 33. Governments can take away your rights through Section 33. So that seems to imply that, contrary to the notion that what Section 33 does is override a judicial interpretation of a right, that it's actually taking away the right itself, which implicitly delivers the message that it's the court that has supreme interpretation of the meaning of the Constitution, which I would argue is the flaw in most of the dialogue theorists. So when I think of you seem to be providing us with an empirical way, or a way of understanding empirically whether judicial policy supremacy exists. That is there a real conflict? Is there normative authority? Is there enforcement? If one of those things is missing, then you can't talk about judicial, or there won't be judicial policy supremacy. I can't tell if it's a predictive or a descriptive.
I would say it's more descriptive rather than, you know, so and I would say, I would also caution that I wouldn't necessarily say that you need robust of all three things, you know, so that I think that if you have a substantial portion of that going, you know, that, so that, I think it's easy to set up a straw man where to say, put these three in the strongest form, you'll never find judicial supremacy. I agree that would be sort of a trivial argument. So, you know, I would say that sort of you need just some combination, you know, that without, you know, wanting too much. I think that's a fascinating question, and that is interesting the way that Section 33 is worded, that it does, you know, that the notwithstanding language implies that, oh, there's a right, it's just that courts can, you know, the legislatures can ignore the right as opposed to legislatures are able to disagree with the interpretation of the charter. So I do think that is, so that you can argue, therefore, that when, you know, were the, you know, were a legislature to get policy supremacy, it still wouldn't have, you know, interpretive supremacy. You know, I think that, again, and I think that, again, is very similar to the point Jacob made, and I think that is a potentially important modification. Although I still think that we care primarily about interpretive supremacy because of the policy supremacy. So that what makes it interesting or relevant is the assumption that the interpretive supremacy carries some weight in terms of the actual outcome. And the other thing I would say, though, is that I do think that's where the sort of my normative authority criterion is relevant. That judicial supremacy in terms of interpretive authority, you should at least see that having some effect on the polity. And again, I don't mean that everybody should immediately agree with any decision that's handed down, but it's striking, and again, in City of Bernie, which is, you know, I think the most obvious recent example of a strong assertion of judicial supremacy, that, you know, basically the entire United States Congress is willing to, within 3 years, repudiate a decision, and a decision that certainly could be wrong, but was not obviously outrageous or unreasonable by any means. So that, you know, I think that there's something to that, but I do think that that seems to be the frequent failure of the Supreme Court really to establish normative authority, even in those narrow terms, is reflected by that. So that reefer isn't just about policy supremacy, but it's also about, to me, it's about that Congress pretty clearly rejecting the interpretive authority of the Supreme Court over the free exercise clause. So that, you know, that I think that there still are cases in which the Supreme Court's interventions aren't accepted as exclusive by the other branches. In ways you might expect. I would actually expect that the Canadian case might be stronger there. That ironically, that the presence, and if I interpret your book correctly, that's part of the point you're making, is that oddly, giving the legislatures that power has almost made them more reluctant to use it in a strange way, that almost legislators in the United States are more creative about getting around that. So I think that's an interesting thing, and that's perhaps the next leg of my project, I think, is to delve more deeply into the Canadian case, because I think you can make a case that the normative authority of Canadian courts might actually be stronger, that there would be fewer cases of, outside again of the unique example of Quebec, of other political actors being willing to come out and say that the court was wrong, as opposed to, we'll work with this interpretation and try to find some way around it. So I think that, interesting, you know, paradoxically, that the case might actually be stronger for judicial supremacy in Canada than it is in the United States, although that seems counterintuitive. So I think that's a great point. Another something on the research agenda. So that's always a productive talk when that happens. Oh, yeah, back there.
Thank you. I'm just curious if you're correct about this, especially about the judiciary not having the normative force. Why do you think the scholarly community and the popular imagination has grasped onto this notion of judicial supremacy?
You know, that's really interesting. I don't know that I have a good answer for that. I mean, I guess certainly, Barry Friedman has a long series, you know, sort of a multi-part series about the sort of what he rise of this, the counter-majoritarian difficulty, this way of thinking about judicial review as being inherently counter-majoritarian, and that sort of being the basis of how we think about its legitimacy, even if we think it's legitimate, that's the way to think about it. And again, that's something I'm going to come back to tomorrow. But, you know, I don't know. It's very interesting to me that the assertions that the court makes in cases like Cooper versus Aaron and City of Bernie get taken at face value, even by people who themselves are very skeptical of the value of judicial supremacy and very skeptical about whether it's necessary. You know, and I find that particular, and again, I think that in some level I can understand why some scholars find it attractive simply because they still kind of work within that counter-majoritarian framework. It is very puzzling to me why that's the punchline to, say, Whittington's book. You know, that when he goes through all of these normative disagreements about between the branches, and very carefully looks at all the ways in which judicial review benefits the political branches, it's weird that the punchline is judicial supremacy. And I guess he might have a good argument for that, but he doesn't. It's just sort of the assumed punchline. You know, he doesn't. you know, there's no final chapter where he says, well, having all this, this is why we call what we have judicial supremacy. It just sort of hangs there, that he sort of, you know, again, it's sort of like the way in which, you know, Marbury was just is just taken to have established judicial review, even though I don't think anybody really thinks that, you know, that again, that everybody sort of assumes that Marshall was ducking a political fight rather than engaging in one. But I think that we just, for whatever reason, we often just don't push to a logical extreme. It's sort of easier to go along with that. So, you know, I don't know that. If I ever see Keith at a conference, I'll have to ask him. So he, you know, you might have a good answer. But, you know, and again, I probably took it for granted, too. I don't exempt myself from that. I think it's one of those things that just, it seems right. And it really wasn't until various things provoked me into trying to think about it. And that's, you know, I to the extent that this paper, I hope, has a cut into the literature, is that I'm not aware of anybody who's really tried to think carefully about what judicial supremacy means in this way before. So there's a ton of literature about what the implications are, how it came to be. But apart from the most basic definition, I don't think we've really bored down into. And again, part of our conclusion may be that we have judicial supremacy in some respects, but not others. So that there may be useful, it may be very useful to sort of disentangle policy supremacy from some narrow kind of interpretive supremacy. So I'm certainly not arguing that the concept has no value or won't describe. And won't describe something, but that at least we should think these things through. And I'm just not sure that for whatever reason we have. But again, part of that is that you can't contest everything. That part of what you have to do as a scholar is accept some basis, accept some generalizations, and then burrow down into something. So I'm sort of burrowing down into this one, but there may be a variety of good reasons why other scholars have not wanted to do that. And of course, there are many scholars who presumably will disagree with me about this. So they'll keep talking because they think that judicial supremacy is the best way of describing that. Which is fair enough too. So hopefully that addressed your question.
Hi, I'm still a bit confused whether the point you're making is more of a conceptual one or of an empirical one.
Okay.
The conceptual one in my mind would be something like, you know, saying that courts are supreme doesn't actually mean anything, and we haven't really realized that. And so courts could not possibly be supreme. The empirical one would be something like, well, courts could be supreme, and we can think of how, like, of an example, for example. They just aren't supreme in the United States and Canada. And I'll just continue a bit on that. One way to think of that would be to find a place where we say, well, that is a Supreme Court. And a court might be supreme if there's a case where Congress says no, and the President says no, and the court says yes. And then can push through this policy change. And there has been a literature concerning developing countries recently about something that they call, I think, courting social rights. So pushing through social change and change to the status quo through constitutional courts. And there's been books, there's been cases in India, in South Africa quite a bit.
Hungary would be a good one, yeah.
Exactly. And I'm just one I think of, for example, is in Colombia a few years ago. The court is said to be quite active there. And at some point they just said, you know what, the government gets education policy wrong. Like, the way you've looked at primary education just isn't constitutional. You have to change everything. So the government had to redo its entire education policy, even though it was claiming it didn't really have the funds to do it, it didn't really want to do it, just because the court came in and was like, you know, we looked at this and this doesn't work. So are you saying something like that? Are you saying, like, maybe Colombia, I mean, maybe not this case, but, you know, there is a Supreme Court out there. We're not like them.
Yeah, I would definitely say in those terms, it's more of an empirical than a conceptual argument. That is, I'm not arguing that the concept of judicial supremacy is inherently meaningless. I'm not sure whether it adequately describes the American case that it's often taken to describe. So I would absolutely, I mean, I think that in laying out this criterion, I am absolutely open to the fact that here's a case that clearly is a yes. You know, so that I hope, and I've tried to emphasize that I'm not trying to set this up so that no country can ever satisfy that. You know, I don't see any reason in theory why that wouldn't be possible. And I do think that there are, and again, I think part of the difficulty with this kind of argument, and this is part of, I think, the problem that sort of all scholars doing this, and I guess when you say empirical, there's some, you know, political scientists would think that this kind of, you know, arty-farty stuff is not really empirical, you know, that it's really theory, no matter what you call it, but that basically that, you know, looking into the relationship between courts and legislatures is just something that's sort of resistant to large-end studies, that you really have to look at a policy field over time. You know, you have to sort of look at how things evolved. You have to try to as reliable as you can ascertain the preferences of the various actors. You know, it's very difficult. So I think that, that part of that is that I absolutely am open that there could be other contexts in which the courts can genuinely impose interpretations on other branches that the other branches are clearly resistant to. I absolutely would not rule that out at all. And I would not even rule out that we'll find very good examples of that in the American case. So, you know, I'm definitely, I certainly don't mean this to be an unfalsifiable, you know, that I don't have kind of an underhanded point that really the term is meaningless. So, you know, that's not what I think. I think it's a potentially very meaningful term. I think that it might be sort of overused or that we might want to think more carefully about it. But I absolutely would hope that you know, if this paper ends up getting any traction, that some comparative scholars will come to me and say, no, here's where I can show that in country X and country Y, we really see what's going on. And I think that would be fine, because I absolutely think that it could be a useful term. My point is not that it's a useless term, just that it's perhaps applied in cases where it's less obviously applicable. So like that's a great question. So I hope that clarifies things. But yeah, absolutely, I don't mean this to be to be setting up an impossible test or a test merely designed to reveal that the concept has no value. I think the concept is potentially meaningful and valuable, and that if we do have judicial supremacy, that does present, you know, different kinds of questions for the democratic legitimacy of judicial review. Not necessarily better or worse for the courts, but different.
Hi.
I'm going to in a movie. There has to be feedback at some point.
I'm going to bite the bullet. I hope I don't offend you or Dean Manfredi. But I find comfort in the Canadian courts saying that the courts are the last line of defense of the citizen. Is there something inherently wrong in being an advocate of judicial supremacy?
Not necessarily. You know, I would say, I mean, again, my only caution, again, is that I'm not, you know, I would just say, be careful about assuming that the courts will always, you know, stand up for the vision of values that you yourself hold. You know, that generally, if you look at countries that have robust forms of judicial review, their record of protecting the rights of minorities is not necessarily reliable. Now, again, I'm not somebody who is, you know, and again, I'll have much more to say about this tomorrow, but, you know, I'm not myself strongly opposed to judicial review, and I'm inclined to think that it probably is more defensible than a lot of the other, you know, that democracy always has to have some way of protecting minority interests, and I think that in some contexts, judicial review works fine, and I think that it may sort of lead, you know, that it may sort of on balance produce, you know, somewhat better outcomes. And I think that there's a variety of ways, you know, that it, a lot of that depends where you're coming from. You know, that particularly, you know, if you're a libertarian, you're probably going to like judicial review because the courts are generally more likely to say no to every, you know, so that just kind of slightly tilts that. You know, if you're not, it kind of depends on what you expect courts to do, you know, what role they have. But I don't think there's anything normatively wrong with it necessarily. That's kind of a separate argument, and I think a very complicated one. But I don't, you know, it's not that I find the idea of judicial supremacy necessarily normative, although I myself lean towards, you know, wanting sort of everybody in a political system to be thinking about constitutional rights. And I don't think necessarily, I think that the courts might have some comparative advantage, but that it's overstated. So that I do worry that taking judicial supremacy for granted may lead to more inattention on the part of other political actors. Again, whether that happens or not is very difficult to prove or disprove, but I have some concerns about it, but I'm not necessarily, I wouldn't say I have any strong conclusion about the idea of courts being the last line of defense. And again, also keep in mind that under my framework, there are many times in which what the court says ends up being the policy baseline, so that there are many rights decisions handed out by the courts that are going not to be overruled. Even if judicial supremacy is not the way to describe that, the courts are certainly going to have the power to do things like enforce rights. So clearly the courts have power, and they have the power to reach constitutional judgments and do that in ways that change policy. The only question is, you know, how exactly we want to describe that. So that I'm not sure that even if you buy my sort of empirical argument, that doesn't necessarily mean that what you would like the courts to be doing isn't what's happening. And then, of course, that also gets to the questions raised earlier about what the value of judicial supremacy has is what, you know, maybe it has power as an idea, even if it might be kind of a noble lie or a noble half truth or something, but that it has value. And I can't, that'd be something that I'd have to think about a lot more. But I would say that I would not definitely say no to that. You know, that there may be some value there for sure. please. Yeah, no.
I'm not offended, but I think it's important to come back to that last quote from Justice Deschamps in the Shuley case. Courts are the last line of defense for citizens. She didn't say courts are the last line of defense for minority citizens or courts are the last line of defense for discrete and insular minorities. She said citizens broadly understood. And the context of that case, of course, is judicial review of a policy adopted by a majority that applies to a majority, that which was the public monopoly over healthcare, which one could argue the majority made a trade-off of certain things to get something else that they thought overall was better. As I've written in other places, if I were a legislator, I would probably vote for a policy close to the one that the Supreme Court articulated in Shuley, but I think it's judicial review is a really bad way to make healthcare policy, at least on constitutional grounds. So that statement, courts are the last line of defense of citizens, as opposed to what you've just said, of minorities or discrete insular minorities, minority citizens. It gets to this point that, you know, Tushnet talks about the notion of democratic debilitation, that you started out your talk by saying that, you know, we don't have judicial supremacy in some cases because legislators have an incentive to let courts take over particularly controversial questions. In Canada, same-sex marriage, for example, would be the best example, and maybe in the U.S. too. Yeah. Nobody wants to touch that. So for me as a citizen, I say, why do we let them get away with that? Why do we let the legislators get away with that? We're complicit in it too. And we sort of, one reason for criticizing the courts for doing these things is because I'd like legislators to actually try to take responsibility for having to make difficult decisions.
I think another excellent example of that would be Morgenthaler. That what's interesting is that, you know, what Morgenthaler actually said was actually a fairly narrow. It said, you know, this particular mechanism is arbitrary, but, you know, the courts, at least theoretically, have a wide, you know, leeway in which to regulate abortion, and in a classic example of delegation, the government allowed the Senate to kill a bill that was passed, which is pretty much the Canadian equivalent of saying we don't want anything. Like we'll delegate that to anybody as long as it's not us. You know, so that, you know, and I think that, and I do think that I do want to emphasize that you know, that one way of looking at this sort of general, you know, the fact that the courts and legislators are often collaborators, that can be seen to be telling a sunnier story about the courts and democratic legitimacy. That if the biggest concern about the courts is that there are nine dictators in black robes imposing their will, you know, we don't necessarily always have to worry about that. But that doesn't, you know, that's not to be an apologist for the court or to say that there are no democratic problems. That this issue of, you know, the courts dodging responsibility. And in the American system, at least, you know, the blame shifting is so endemic that it doesn't, you know, that in a Madisonian framework, you know, there's never any way for any one actor to take responsibility. So judicial review is arguably less of a concern just because it'll happen anyway. But in a Canadian Westminster system where you have a system of responsible government in which at least the electorate can have a very clear idea of who's responsible for what, to the extent that judicial review can dilute that, that is one democratic concern. Now, that's not a knockdown argument against judicial review or anything like that, but I think that that's a very real concern. So that if we don't have to worry about the courts, you know, imposing their will on majorities who are strongly opposed to that, that doesn't end all the problems of democratic legitimacy. That it can introduce some of this kind of American tendency to sort of shift blame and shift responsibility and dilute accountability. And anybody who's been following the recent, you know, the recent issues over the, you know, the government shutdown and so on knows that there are a lot of upsides to a Madisonian system, but this dilution of accountability has problems too. So I think that's a very important point. That and again, if you're interested in these questions, I urge you to come. It's 11 tomorrow. I'll be speaking at the law school. I think addressing this stuff more directly, because I think that's an interesting question that I think often people that make our arguments are seen as being apologists for the court, but that's not what we're, you know, that we're saying that the democratic problems of judicial review are different, not that they're eliminated. And I think that's something that Dean Manfredi and Mark Tushnet and various other people have taken pains to emphasize.
And with that, we are just about out of time. As Professor Lemieux mentioned, he'll be giving a paper in the legal theory workshop tomorrow in the Faculty of Law at 11 o'clock. I believe that undergraduates probably didn't get any notice about that, but if you are here and are interested in going to the workshop, mention it to me at the reception so that I can email you the paper in advance. And having come tonight, I think you'll be in a good position to take part tomorrow as well. I remind you that this series will return on April 3rd with a debate on open borders at Thompson House. Following the lecture, we will have a reception upstairs in the billiard room. Please join us for that. And please join me in thanking Scott Levine.
And thank you for a terrific audience. I really appreciate it. Thank you.